If dehumanization is the first step toward anything, then rehumanization is the hardest step back. It is not automatic. It does not happen just because the violence ends or the system collapses. It requires deliberate effort, the conscious choice to see what we once unlearned, to see the humanity of the other. And that work is neither quick nor easy. Rehumanization begins with recognition. Not abstract recognition, not numbers on a page, but faces, names, stories. The act of looking at someone not as a symbol or a role, but as a whole being. This is deceptively simple. It can happen in a conversation, a photograph, a moment of listening. But simple is not the same as easy. Because to recognize someone's humanity after it has been denied is to confront the reasons we denied it in the first place. It means facing the fear, the prejudice, the laziness that made it convenient to see them as less. It means acknowledging that the categories were never true, only useful. And once we admit that, we can no longer hide behind them. Rehumanization begins by tearing down our own excuses. History shows us examples of this. In South Africa, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission forced perpetrators and survivors into the same room. The act of telling and hearing stories did not erase the violence, but it restored recognition. In Rwanda, communities rebuilt by having neighbors face one another again, not as cockroaches, but as human beings. These processes were painful, imperfect, but they carved out space for rehumanization in places where it seemed impossible. But rehumanization is not only for societies after atrocities. It is for classrooms where students are reduced to scores. It is for workplaces where people are reduced to functions. It is for families where members are reduced to roles. Everywhere dehumanization happens, rehumanization must follow. Otherwise, the erosion continues. At its core, rehumanization is the act of restoring complexity. It insists that no person is only one thing, not only illegal, not only patient, not only failure. It demands that we widen our vision, that we refuse to let categories shrink people down to caricatures. To rehumanize is to resist reduction. And sometimes, rehumanization is as small as language. Calling someone by their name, asking a question instead of making an assumption, telling a story that gives depth instead of repeating a stereotype. The smallest shifts in words can open space for empathy to return. Language can wound, but it can also mend. Listening is another act of rehumanization. Not the kind of listening that waits for its turn to speak, but the kind that risks being changed by what it hears. Listening does not mean agreement. It means granting the other the dignity of being heard in their own voice, on their own terms. That act alone restores what dehumanization strips away, the sense that someone's story matters. But we must be honest. Rehumanization is slow. It does not offer the quick satisfaction of outrage. It requires patience, humility, and discomfort. Because to rehumanize another, we must confront the parts of ourselves that prefer simplicity over complexity, categories over nuance, silence over empathy. It is as much inner work as it is outer work. The risk of rehumanization is vulnerability. To see the other as human is to admit that their suffering could be yours. It breaks the distance that keeps us safe. It forces us to feel, and feeling is heavy. But without that vulnerability, empathy never grows. And without empathy, cruelty always finds a way back. Rehumanization also means resisting the temptation of reversal. It is easy to say, they dehumanized us, so now we dehumanize them. That logic feels like justice, but it only repeats the same pattern in reverse. To fight dehumanization with more dehumanization is to reinforce the very structure we claim to oppose. The cycle breaks only when we refuse to step onto it again. This refusal is not weakness, it is strength, because it is easier to reduce someone than to restore them. It is easier to strike back than to listen. Rehumanization requires courage, the courage to hold the mirror steady without smashing it, the courage to see the reflection, even when it's unbearable. Sometimes rehumanization begins not with the other, but with ourselves. How often do we reduce ourselves to roles, to job titles, to failures, to the worst thing we've done? Dehumanization turns inward, teaching us to treat ourselves as tools or burdens. To rehumanize others, we must also rehumanize ourselves. We must remember that we, as well, are more than the categories assigned to us. Collective rehumanization begins in these small, personal shifts. The conversation slowed down to make space for a story. The workplace policy rewritten to recognize dignity instead of only efficiency. The community that chooses to welcome rather than exclude. These gestures are not grand, but they are seeds. And seeds, when tended, grow into culture. The work of rehumanization is never finished. It is not a box to be checked, not a problem to be solved once and for all. It is a daily practice, a discipline of perception and action. Because every day, we face the temptation to reduce, to flatten, to categorize. And every day, we have the chance to resist. The fight against dehumanization is not only about the horrors of history, it is about the choices we make right now. Rehumanization also demands imagination. To see someone differently, we must imagine them outside the role we've assigned. The refugee is not only a migrant, but a musician, a parent, a friend. The prisoner is not only an offender, but someone with fears, regrets, and memories of joy. Imagination expands the frame, reminding us that no category captures the whole of a life. But imagination is not sentimental, it is radical. It refuses the simplifications that systems and slogans demand. It insists that people are irreducible, even when it is inconvenient, even when it complicates the story. Rehumanization is the courage to live in that complication, to accept that others are as messy, contradictory, and layered as we are ourselves. This courage is not evenly distributed. Some are asked to rehumanize while still carrying fresh wounds. Survivors, the marginalized, the excluded, they often carry the greatest burden. It is unjust to demand that they do the work alone. Rehumanization must be collective, carried by those with power, as much as by those without it. Collective rehumanization looks like policies rewritten with dignity at the center. It looks like education that teaches complexity instead of caricature. It looks like leaders who resist the easy applause of division. It looks like communities that choose hospitality over suspicion. It is not perfect, but it is possible. And its possibility is the antidote to despair. Because despair is the ally of dehumanization. When we believe nothing can change, we stop trying. When we stop trying, cruelty grows unchecked. Hope is not naive. It is necessary. Not blind hope that everything will be fine, but grounded hope that change is possible when enough people refuse the logic of reduction. The challenge is that rehumanization is fragile. It can be undone by a single act of cruelty, a single phrase that cuts, a single policy that excludes. That fragility makes the work exhausting. But fragility does not mean futility. It means the work must be tended constantly, like a flame that will die if left alone. We must also recognize that rehumanization is not symmetrical. Not everyone can reconcile, not every wound can heal, and not every division can be bridged. To say otherwise is to risk trivializing suffering. But even when reconciliation is impossible, recognition is not. We can still refuse to erase. We can still resist the temptation to flatten. Resistance takes many forms. Sometimes it's public protest. Sometimes it's private refusal. Sometimes it's as small as refusing to laugh at a cruel joke, or as large as rewriting the language of law. Each form matters, because each one interrupts the rhythm of dehumanization. Interruption is itself a form of rehumanization. The truth is, there is no single method. Rehumanization is not a program to implement, but a posture to adopt. It is an orientation toward others, a commitment to complexity, a refusal of easy erasure. The forms it takes will differ by context, but the essence is the same: to see fully, to hear deeply, to recognize always. And yes, it is exhausting, because dehumanization is efficient. It saves time, saves energy, saves us from the discomfort of care. Rehumanization asks us to slow down, to feel, to risk. It is work that resists the current of culture, and resistance always costs something, but the cost of not resisting is greater. The cost is a world where cruelty becomes normal, where indifference becomes habit, where violence becomes inevitable. If we do not choose rehumanization, we do not choose neutrality, we choose erosion. We choose to let dignity be chipped away until there is nothing left to defend. Rehumanization is not optional if humanity itself is to endure. This work does not belong only to governments or institutions. It belongs to us, in our conversations, our workplaces, our classrooms, our families. The spaces we inhabit every day are where humanity is either rehearsed or reduced. And in those spaces, our choices matter. Not grand choices, but small ones, repeated over time until they shape the culture itself. Every gesture counts. Every refusal to flatten, every insistence on dignity, every act of listening, every name remembered. No single act will transform the world, but together, these acts weave the fabric of rehumanization strong enough to resist the weight of cruelty. It is not spectacular work, but it is sustaining work. And perhaps that is the point. Rehumanization is not about spectacle. It is about persistence. It is about cultivating habits of empathy so deeply that they become instinct, so that when the temptation to reduce appears, the instinct to resist is already there. So that when cruelty presses close, our first reflex is recognition, not erasure. So as we close this segment, remember this: dehumanization is easy. It is efficient, seductive, everywhere. Rehumanization is harder. It is fragile, costly, inconvenient. But it is also the only way forward, because without it, history repeats itself. And with it, even in fragile forms, humanity has a chance to endure.